the group that the IFD is the most threatening, other than immigrants, is trans people. We know what the far right does when it gets into power regarding trans people, right?
Welcome to the Heist Podcast. I'm Benjamin Stoller. This is one of the three episodes we're dropping to really kick off the podcast. This episode features Ben Miller, but we're also publishing conversations with Heba Jamal about life as a Palestinian in Berlin and Yossi Bartal about a faked murder on the U-Bahn. So do check those out in the Heist Podcast feed. Anyway, Ben Miller is a historian and also the host of Bad Gays, a podcast about what it sounds like, bad gays in history. We highly recommend it. It's really great. He also wrote one of the first features for Heist back in March, which was commissioned by founding editor Peter Matthews, who you'll hear interview Ben in this episode. Their conversation starts as a discussion about a political billboard in Brandenburg that was put up by an AfD candidate there, so a far-right candidate, and it featured rather prominently a homophobic Nazi symbol. But from there, Ben and Peter talk about how the AfD takes actually what can look like a very moderate position when it comes to queer politics, and how that position legitimizes the AfD and also attracts liberals to it in an interesting kind of move. You'll also hear what happened with the shots fired at the Schwules Museum a couple years ago and how violence against pro-Palestinian protesters at pride marches really just plays into the AfD's hands these days. All right, let's get into the interview. You can read Ben Miller's entire feature about what this episode is about at heistberlin.com. I'll link to it in the show notes. But for now, here's Peter Matthews and Ben Miller.
We're here with Ben Miller, the historian and writer who...
And gay wrongs activist.
Who wrote a feature for Heist, one of our early features, which we want to discuss here. And so we reached out to you when we saw some campaigning in the Uckermark, which had a kind of problematic historical connection. An AfD candidate was seen to be using a pink triangle in reference to his lesbian rival. Can you just explain why was that considered a problem and set the context for us there?
So yeah, what happened was in the Uckermark in Brandenburg, which is this very kind of hip vacation from Berlin destination. If you have a friend who has a summer house in Brandenburg, it's probably in the Uckermark. There was an election for this Landrat position or Landräten position, which is basically like the elected mayor of a rural area, large rural area. And it came down to the incumbent CDU, a woman named Karina Dirk, and a challenger from the AfD named Felix Teichner. And when I wrote the feature, the election results weren't in yet. We now know that Dirk has won re-election rather handily, 60-40. Although last time, 6 years ago, she won re-election against the SPD, and now she's won re-election against the AfD. But yeah, on the posters, his slogan was a real change instead of more of the same. And he used AI. This is like an Ouroboros of stupid fascist crap. He used AI to make Karina Dirk make the Angela Merkel hand rhombus thing.
Yeah,
and then he put her doing that inside an upside down pink triangle, which he then claimed was just created by the party's general like corporate design, where there's all these like X's and crossing lines. And then his answer when asked, wasn't this sort of homophobic because the upside down pink triangle is a symbol, or rather right side up pink triangle is a symbol from concentration camps for gay inmates. He said, no. And by the way, it's actually really ridiculous that you ask me that question because our party is the only one that has a lesbian leader at a national level, Alice Weidel. And the weird thing is he's right.
Yeah.
About that, if nothing else.
Yeah. Why do you think that the AfD would use this symbol? Why do you think they would think that was a winning slogan for them?
Well, I think it's like many things with the AfD, part of a very and I think people who aren't maybe in Germany and aren't necessarily familiar with the AfD will recognize this from their local far right. Part of a strategy of provocation, chosen provocation with plausible deniability, right? So on the one hand, for that core group of really homophobic neo-Nazis, who I think are a small minority even in rural Brandenburg, but those people, you are signaling to them, we see you, we believe you, you can vote for us, you are on our side. And one of the scariest things about the AfD is how successful they are at mobilizing non-voters. And one of the reasons is because there just is a group of Germans who have like neo-fascist beliefs, who have not had a political home for a long time. Some of them found their place on the kind of right wing of the CDU or of the FDP, and there were these different other small far-right parties in the 90s and early 2000s, but they now have this very kind of successful chosen political home. And then it's plausibly deniable just enough for everyone else, right? You know, you form the shape out of this swoosh that you already use on your posters. You know, the pink is one of the colors that they're using, right? And then you have this answer that, oh, well, our leader's a lesbian, so how could it possibly be homophobic? So then for those people who kind of want to vote for the AfD but don't want to see it, explaining to them why it's fucked up makes you almost sound like a conspiracy theorist, because suddenly you're having a 15-minute conversation about the design of a campaign poster and people are like, what? Like, it, you know, it doesn't make any sense. And even Weidel herself, the queer woman, is not immune to this. Like, there's this moment, you know, when for people who don't know, Berlin's, I think I say in the piece, almost alarmingly heterosexual mayor, Kai Wegner, was caught with his pants down. He went and played tennis during this blackout that where all these people were without power in the freezing cold. And, you know, he said he was on the job and talking to everybody, and it turns out he was off playing tennis and lied about it. And when this came out, Weidel posted a picture where of Kai Wegner playing tennis where AI was used to make his tennis outfit rainbow. Right? And, like, this had nothing to do with... None of this had anything to do with his, like, policy, right? It was just Kai Wegner is someone who in the CDU, because he leads the Berlin CDU, is, you know, comparatively within the CDU, quite in favor of gay and lesbian and even, I think, trans civil equality. Like, Kai Wegner is one of the voices in the CDU who doesn't fight transphobic culture wars. But and so, like, here's Weidel herself, like, she's the one who is married to a woman, right? Just kind of using the rainbow.
Yeah. He was also playing tennis with his girlfriend.
Right. As with his girlfriend who, by the way, is also a CDU senator in this government. And the fact that when this government came together, their relationship was made public. And the fact that I was forced to imagine two 50-year-old people in the CDU having sex with each other is, I would like to file a lawsuit against somebody for having to think about that.
Yeah.
God.
That's true. But I think one of the things that your article did really well was unpacking a bit the odd relationship between the German far right and the European far right more generally with LGBT politics. And even that they have Alice Weidel, a lesbian leader who explicitly doesn't want to be called queer. You know, can you unpack that for us? What is the relationship in the AfD to their sort of queer politics?
Sure. Well, the AfD is a structurally extremely homophobic party. Even more so, it's a structurally deeply transphobic party. And it's a party that is really invested in gender relations as an expression of the need for a particular kind of German racial flourishing. And if that is scary to you, it should be. The misapprehension, I think, that always gets made about the Nazis, and this is something that Dagmar Herzog writes really well about in some of her more recent work, is that the Nazi era was this kind of wet blanket of sexual conservatism thrown on top of the Weimar interwar years. And in fact, the Nazis were extremely interested and invested in sexual pleasure, in even a certain kind of libertinage, as long as that enforced proper eugenic breeding and the reproduction of an imagined Aryan race than itself imagined to be superior to other races.
Right. Lots of the leaders had sort of orgy houses.
Yeah, there's a lot of, you know, it's, and so there's you know, the Nazi crackdown on homosexuality was because it was thought to be a degenerate condition that prevented proper racial reproduction. There were also, and this is difficult to talk about because for a long time, kind of small-C conservatives spread this idea to try to discredit the idea that there were queer victims of the Nazis, right? Like, gay and queer people were writ large victims of National Socialist persecution. But some were also survivors and some were also collaborators. And there were people like Ernst Röhm, who was one of the founders of the SA, that network of paramilitaries that ended up becoming the SS, who was very openly homosexual. He understood his homosexuality as part of a kind of coherent masculine political identity. And his homosexuality was, if not accepted, then at least tolerated by other party leaders, so long as he was useful to their project of advancement. And of course, as soon as he was no longer useful to his to their project of advancement, he was disposed of, murdered, using that homosexuality as an excuse, although it was something that they had, of course, known about all along.
So how do you think that kind of deep right-wing queer past embodied by someone like Röhm, how does that relate to the German far-right today?
Well, so you have this fascinating figure, Alice Weidel, who says, you know, I'm married to a woman, but I'm not queer. She's actually married to a Sri Lankan woman who, rumor has it, has been seen at Bergheim now and again. And that is a person who I really want to talk to. Alice Weidel's immigrant lesbian wife. Woo! That would be a conversation. But anyway, she's made her bed and she's lying in it as we speak. Weidel's position of being able to say that and then simultaneously being able to advocate a structurally queerphobic politics that, like Nazi structurally queerphobic politics, imagines gender nonconformity as a kind of racial degeneracy and imagines any threat to racial reproduction as being extremely scary and suspect, that she is then also able to herself be in this interracial lesbian relationship where she's raising two children. It's evidence of both the degree to which denial is not just a river in Egypt, and also of, paradoxically, the success of a certain kind of depoliticized liberal gay and lesbian rights policy framework that enables people to feel so secure in their own integration into the majority that they are then able to turn around and advocate for harsh anti-minoritarian politics of attack and persecution.
Yeah, I think it's good. I think it's interesting to unpack that, and I think your piece does a good job of it. But exactly that thing, how the AFD or sort of some far-right LGBT position across Europe sort of uses the idea of their own position as a sort of shield to deflect criticism, as you see in this case when they say, oh, we can't be being homophobic because we have a lesbian leader. But then they also use the implied threat, which they themselves bring up, of immigrants and how immigrants are the intolerant ones. You know, like there's Muslims coming who have a bad position on LGBT politics, who are homophobic or whatever, and so then they can use their position at once to sort of deflect criticism and also to criticize their designated enemy.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, this all goes back to one of the kind of fathers of the European new far right, a Dutch man named Pim Fortuyn, whom was kind of openly gay in a way that Weidel isn't, right? Weidel will say, I'm married to a woman, but I'm not queer. We can talk later about what that distinction means. Fortuyn would give TV interviews during the election campaign where he talked about dark rooms and what semen tasted like. I mean, he was gay. And that was a big part of his, presentation, right? And he had entered into politics through the Dutch Labor Party, but then founded his own kind of far-right anti-immigrant list. And one of the big arguments that he made in order to convince Dutch people who thought of themselves as liberal that the most liberal thing to do, the way to defend Dutch liberalism, was to vote for someone who referred to, and I'm sorry for the word I'm about to use, but Moroccan culture as retarded, was by convincing them that the immigrants presented a threat to this liberalism. And as someone who could impersonate that liberalism, he could credibly make that claim. He could say, in a country like the Netherlands, I get to be a politician, despite the fact that I talk about going to cruising bars and I'm, you know, and there are people coming to this country who want to change that. And I want to save our country and I want to save our rights from that. And it was extremely effective. And had he not been assassinated by an animal rights activist, he likely would have become prime minister of the Netherlands in 2002. And so you see that lesson then start to spread, right, where these different parties and one thing that's kind of interesting and terrifying about the AfD is that the pattern in many places, like France, for example, has been that these parties moderate in some ways, right? Like Marine Le Pen rejects her father's anti-Semitism and Holocaust denialism, kicks him out of the party for it, and then is seen to be rewarded by having, you know, eliminated that sort of some of the evil, right? The AfD is radicalizing as it gains popularity. But still, I think there is an element of appeal to a certain kind of voter who sees the gay and lesbian civil rights consensus as an emblem of the parts of liberalism they don't really mind, right? Like, I don't think that there is a vast backlash of people, even if you went out in the most AfD voting areas and started interviewing people. I think you'll find very committed Nazis for whom voting for the AfD is part of a project of extremely committed neo-Nazism and neo-fascism. But I think that will be a small group of people. And I think you'll find many more people who vote for the AfD who are racist, who have racist beliefs, who believe that this party is going to do something for them, who feel left behind in all sorts of ways. And I don't think the majority of those people are going to actually say that the most important or salient political issue for them is overturning gay marriage. Right. I don't think they want to. And you know, some of them do, but some of them don't. Right. And I think having someone like Vital at the head allows the party to give off a certain air of having accepted certain things about the way that the world is. And then you have someone who is careful to distinguish the fact that she's married to a woman from the fact that she's queer, which I think is really interesting. And again, you know, there's this era back when Röhm is around, and you know, you have all of these these men who love men and in some cases boys, who call themselves masculinists as opposed to homosexuals, right? Because to be homosexual is to be sort of Jewish and effeminate and racially compromised, and to be a masculinist is just to be a superior Aryan guy being a superior Aryan dude with other Aryan guys being dudes, right? And I think, you know, without wanting to ascribe that exact complex to Vital, I think the word queer is doing something quite similar there. I think queer here for her is signifying a kind of identitarian subject position, a way of organizing your life and your politics around something, a kind of gender fluidity, a kind of departure from ordinary gender roles that she's very much not engaging in, right? And, you know, it is actually kind of true in a way. There need not be anything queer about two women raising children if the structure of that family, if the way that everything is working in that family is very kind of hyper traditional or neo traditional or kind of trad. At the same time, of course, what none of this ever kind of grapples with is what happened to Röhm after the Nazis came to power, right? Like, you know, he was discarded as soon as it was useful. And I sort of suspect the same thing would happen to Alice Weidel or to Jens Spahn, the gay, not queer CDU honcho who's been apparently, allegedly behind the scenes, doing a lot of thinking about what CDU-AFD cooperation in the future might look like. And Spahn is also allegedly breathtakingly corrupt. But anyway, my basic position is that Spahn and Vital should be forced to Google Ernst Röhm every day, you know, see what happened to him and to think honestly about what they think is going to happen to them.
I want to go back to Pim Fortuyn for a moment, because I recommend everybody listen to your episode on Bad Gays about him, because it really is quite amazing. It does a really good job also because the time span is so crazy there. It's such a short time. He gets in the, like, he joins politics in, I can't remember the exact date, but like within a year, he's like gone from getting into politics to becoming, to setting up his own party, to being on the verge of being the biggest party, and then being assassinated, as you say, by an animal rights activist. And I think that it's exactly this sort of strategic, perhaps, or just like ambiguity of the position of a kind of height of liberalism being at the same time the height of kind of anti-migrant politics. Do you think that he sort of sets the template for the modern right?
I do. I mean, I think his politics are more liberal than the politics of the AfD, right? He's not operating at a time when, I'm actually not familiar if there's anything that he said about trans people. I'm not sure. But he certainly was not operating at a time when the kind of anti-trans politics were as mobilizing for the right as they are now. But he's certainly someone who is mobilizing anti-immigrant sentiment in very similar ways, and who kind of debuts this line that to protect the achievements of European gay liberation and women's liberation, immigration has to be restricted. And this kind of homo-nationalist or femo-nationalist attitude becomes more and more popular at that time, right? Fortown shoots to popularity right after 9/11. It's not an accident. We start seeing all of this discourse, even among liberals, about the West as a kind of guarantor of women's rights, because we all know the track record of achieving women's rights with bunker-busting bombs is unmatched, and that basically the West is now on a civilizational mission or engaged in a civilizational conflict with a Middle East imagined as backwards, partially because of the status of women and LGBT people. You know, a political figure like Hillary Clinton, who is not on the far right, brings this idea into her work at the U.S. State Department, right? Adding the kind of gay rights or human rights corollary to her women's rights or human rights speech from 1995. And it's not that I'm against the idea of having LGBT rights be a goal of international diplomacy. I mean, I'd much rather have that than whatever it is the State Department is doing now. But it is at least worth thinking about and critiquing the extent to which those narratives can become very quickly racialized, and to which, you know, extremely illiberal migration restriction can become the outcome of those politics, or can be what those politics end up arguing for. And again, in a bizarre way, this is an effect of the success, the kind of historically, in historical comparison, unbelievably rapid success of gay and lesbian civil rights organizing in the 1990s and 2000s. I mean, it really goes unbelievably quickly from legal discrimination and very few protections to strong legal protections and much less discrimination, and public attitudes shift with it. It happens really, really fast. And one of the things that doesn't happen is that the goals of a politics of gay liberation or queer liberation, which are to think about who the sex gender system makes strange and to try to escape from some of those categories, that is not what succeeds. What succeeds is something different and something more limited. And the thing that succeeds has enabled my life, right? Like, I'm aware that I'm standing on top of it, but its limitations set us up for where we are now, where a poll on the German gay dating website Gay Romeo, and again, this is men only. It's like mostly German men. It's like mostly a little older. Like, it's not, this is not necessarily the most representative sample, but they always do a poll of their members of who they're voting for. And the AfD was in first in the last election. Mm-hmm. And similar things have been seen in France, where even representative polling found that gay and lesbian voters voted disproportionately for Marine Le Pen. And it doesn't actually surprise me that when a group has learned that it is now a kind of national minority, that it's protected, and when it is told repeatedly that the greatest danger to it are these hordes of immigrants, that it will act accordingly and try to defend itself against that. And it's, you know, I'm not excusing anyone who votes for these parties. I'm just saying, in a weird way, it's the natural outcome of these kinds of politics. And I think, you know, it's profoundly frustrating to me when people in the German Green Party, which the German Greens are kind of the natural political home of the German liberal gay rights establishment, have sudden aneurysms about people essentially taking the things that they've said so seriously that they stop voting for the Greens and start voting for the AfD, right? Whether that be about the supposed anti-Semitism of migrants or the supposed homophobia of migrants or, you know, the need to strictly integrate them into German culture, which, as we all know, is one that is and has always been based on the impeccable equal treatment of all minorities and people who are visibly different.
I think
he says, joking.
I'd like you to stay on that thought a bit because I think it's interesting, like that Romeo survey, which had, I think, like nearly 30% of users saying that they would vote for the AfD. And there's something about this, like, what do you think are the kind of mechanisms which there seems to be like a project in a way to court like conservative gay voters and sort of make them vote according to other areas where they might align with the more conservative sections of society, like class or race, or instead of foregrounding their sort of sexual position. How do you think that plays out?
I mean, it, exactly as you said, right? When a kind of liberal rights consensus is achieved, one of the things that happens is people are free to vote their class and their social position as opposed to their sexuality, and then they do. It's just as simple as that. One of the things that I think was really interesting, though, is of all of the comments that came in when we first published that article, I had a couple of like German gays get really angry with me about using that Gay Romeo poll and with these complicated explanations of like why it was bullshit. And again, I don't argue that that poll is a scientific representation of what was going on. At the same time, I think the denialism around the fact that this is happening isn't helpful. And I think you have these German gay and lesbian political institutions, which on the one hand are unbelievably, in many cases, racist and extremely depoliticized, and everyone gets together every year and has a big CSD. In Germany, we call Pride Christopher Street Day or Christopher Street Day. And, you know, the theme of Christopher Street Day is something like love is courage, colon, standing up for people together, exclamation point. And anyone who wears a keffiyeh or brings a Palestinian flag is beaten bloody and senseless by the police with the organizer's tacit agreement or encouragement. And then everyone acts surprised or wants to deny the idea that some people at this event have kind of taken it all the way and are voting for a far right political party. And it isn't that surprising. It shouldn't be that surprising. And I share the, I think, very real and very deeply felt horror of these German liberals at the idea that a party like this could be in power and at the idea that a party like this could appeal to gay and lesbian voters. I don't approve of anyone voting for this party, obviously. I do not share the sometimes common kind of pop leftist trope of wanting to say, well, everything now is so bad that if these people get into power, it wouldn't be any worse. No, it would be worse. It can always be worse. It's worth stopping it from getting worse. Worse is worse, right? But I do think that a lot of these institutions are going to have to, if we are to have any hope, think about what they have promoted, about what they have decided, about what they have enforced, and about how their politics has directly led us to where we are now. And that is a much more difficult conversation than them telling everyone that it's time to unite against the far right. And I agree we have to unite against the far right, but we cannot unite against the far right behind a failed leadership which has comprehensively plowed the fields and strewn the seeds for something like the AfD to emerge.
One of the other things that you point out in the analysis of Pim Fortuyn was that he's one of the first people in the European far right that actually makes the shift towards Israel like explicit, I think, in that, you know, at the time the French far right or other European parties were still like had anti-Semitism like baked in as part of their DNA. Mm-hmm. And he's one of the first people that shifts it. And do you think those two things kind of go together in some way?
I think they're both reactions to the same historical events, which is to say 9/11 and the reformatting of the Middle East conflict as being civilizational and between a kind of pro-gay West, which includes Israel, and this backwards Middle East. And that framing, I think, ends up bringing both along. And I think it's entirely opportunistic. Like, one of the strongest speakers in favor of what these Bundestag anti-Semitism resolutions has been Beatrix von Storch, who is the granddaughter of Hitler's finance minister. I do not believe that Beatrix von Storch is engaging in these debates out of a good faith attempt to protect the rights of Jewish people or to fight against anti-Semitism. But I do think that Beatrix von Storch, granddaughter of Hitler's finance minister, who actually specifically thanked the Greens for finally recognizing the migrant anti-Semitism problem. So congratulations, Green Party. You now have the anti-Semitism fighting endorsement of the granddaughter of Hitler's finance minister. But I think she's engaging in this because she sees a way, again, similar as with gay stuff, to try to mobilize people's general sense of wanting to do the right thing against this minority group, right? I think the anti-Semitism taboo in Germany exists for a really good reason. And the fact that it is abused in the way that it is not least as a Jewish person, just profoundly degrading and insulting and terrifying. And so, I think they're related projects, these projects. But I don't think it's somehow the same. But I think both of them are issues where, again, because of this broader civilizational narrative, which liberalism has enthusiastically participated in, the far right has this very easy path to present these ideas to people who find them intuitively appealing. I mean, I had a conversation a couple months ago in a gay bar I'm not going to name, but it's in Schoneberg where I live, as anyone who sees my sneakers can tell you. And I was talking with this very, very sweet sort of like, you know, femme leopard print shirt, frosted tips, mid-60s guy who's always the bartender there. And it's this very sweet neighborhoody bar with these tables and chairs and like a little cabaret stage. And it's all just so, you know, happy, good feelings. And the guy was saying, oh, God, yeah, the neighborhood is really changing. And I said, yeah, you know, it is. You're right. You know, the rent is going up. And the guy at the bar said to me, no, I don't mean that. I just mean that I'm sick of Romania coming and dumping all of its problems on my doorstep in a dump truck. And he was referring to this hotel that has been used for to house some asylum seekers. And, you know, yeah, if you put a bunch of desperately poor people in a hotel with no social services and throw the key away, yeah, the neighbors are going to notice something. Like, you're going to, like, hear some things and see some things. Again, it's not those people's fault. It's the fault of a completely inadequate, like, service provision or whatever. But it was just, I was like, oh, shit. Like that conversation was really, really scary. And I really tried to kind of stay with him and engage. And it wasn't that he was unwilling to engage, right? But this is someone who had, that you could just see, like, exactly happening in front of you how an appeal to someone's racism is succeeding at eroding their solidarity, you know? And that the idea that the way that change in the neighborhood is being framed has to do with security and immigration rather than with the tremendous rises in rents, even though this is someone whose bar is directly threatened by those tremendous rises in rents. I mean, if the landlord ever decides to do something with that space, I'm sure that this like little cabaret bar that sells €3 beer is not going to be competing for paying high rent like a Lap Coffee or a fucking Sparkasse.
You end your piece for Heist in kind of with an appeal for solidarity across different groups, and I want to stress how much the threat in Berlin over the last years has been real. I mean, CSD last year there was like far right groups like gathering alongside to kind of threaten it. I think these that were picked up by police like in an organized way came to target the event. And and also the Schwules Museum, where you're on the board, was shot at a couple of years ago now, I think.
Mm-hmm.
How much do you feel these threats, and how worried are you about the political future in Berlin?
Well, I want to talk about a few things. The group that the AfD is the most threatening, other than immigrants, is trans people. We know what the far right does when it gets into power regarding trans people, right? When the far right comes into power, trans people start having their identity documents revoked. They start having their access to medical care be revoked. In the worst cases, things like forced detransition, right? This is really, really, really deadly serious, and we need to have that kind of first and foremost in our minds as we think about this. There's been certainly in the past several years in Berlin a tremendous increase in the kind of diffuse threat. And I think it's been, you mentioned this instance where the police protect CSD from these far right people. Also, the police beat queer protesters bloody and senseless at the Internationalist Queer Pride March, and have done so repeatedly every year. And because it's pro-Palestine, and not a single German queer institution in this city, not a single one, put out a statement or expressed a word of solidarity with the people who were beaten by cops. And then those are the institutions that then want to say that it's time to kind of come together and fight against the far right. And, you know, I just find that outrageous. If we want to take the threat seriously from the far right, we also have to think about the fact that we know from journalism that the far right have infiltrated the police, right? And we have to know that the Berlin's police president said without evidence that Neukölln, the place where basically half of my gay friends live and hang out, was an unsafe place for gay people to walk around. Well, big news for gay people who go to one of the many gay bars and gay clubs in that neighborhood, right? When the Schwules Museum was shot at, there was a lot of talk about how it must have come from, not from people in the institution, but from people outside the institution who I won't name, it must have come from this refugee housing center over there. And like, of course it didn't. Of course it was the far right. Of course we know this. We know what the threats are. And yet there is just a refusal to engage with any of this, and people would much rather believe, I think, that the threat is external rather than internal, because then it can be controlled. And people, you know, if you offer people a way to give their racism the moral high ground, many of them will take it, because it's easier to do that than it is to think about what you stand on, what you believe, and to be really challenged.
So given that, at the moment in Berlin, what do you think people can do?
I mean, I think that we are in a really decisive moment in a lot of ways. And I think, you know, I find myself in the odd position of on the one hand, believing that it is absolutely time for everyone to kind of get together and fight this far-right threat. And at the same time, getting together behind the banner of the people who have delivered us here is not going to be effective. And it's also insulting to people who are regularly themselves hurt by this German liberalism to tell them to now stand behind it as it attempts to fight off something even worse. So I think the key is to try, for those of us who are able, for those of us who have the kinds of who carry with us the skin color and the German skills that allow us to engage in certain spaces without being hate-crimed, to try to have these conversations with people and to try to bring people towards the urgent necessity to create coalitions that are capable of organizing and fighting and winning. You know, the thing that I think is often misunderstood about Germany is that the there's a real disconnect here between institutions and people, right? Polling about a lot of things is not that different in Germany than it is in other countries. And then but then institutions maintain certain positions. And so I think it's engaging with people about that and about changing that is important and is something that those of us who have the time and the energy and the ability, as I said, to do it without getting hate crime should be trying to do every day.
No, for sure. I mean, I think it's absolutely true that there's something about the a lot of the sort of center-left parties here, which almost seem to use the right as the only real explanation or the only real justification for why you should vote for them. Look how bad they are, without really offering something positive.
There's also a really rich and important history in this city of migrant and post-migrant queer organizing. There's an organization called GLADT, G-L-A-D-T, which has been particularly central to that work. German speakers can buy a book called Nicht die Ersten, which means not the first ones, which is about queer of color histories. And actually, for English speakers, there's going to be a show based on that book called Discontinuities, which is going to open at the Schwules Museum this coming fall, about that kind of queer of color organizing history. And it's something that I think all of us can and should learn a lot from. Because I think that those skills are going to be extremely necessary and useful to all of us. And if we're going to unite behind something, it should be uniting behind something that has a chance of winning and that has not been actively leading us here by excluding people from its politic.
I think that's right, quite right. How can people follow you and your stuff? What can they subscribe to? Or
well, if you're hearing the sound of my voice and you like it, I make a podcast with Hugh Lemmy called Bad Gaze, which can be found wherever fine podcasts are sold or at badgazepod.com. And people should especially check out our recent 5-part miniseries on Peter Mandelson called Mandelson, A Homosexual History. I'm really happy about how that one turned out. And
I'm excited about
it. I am on Instagram at Ben Writes Things, and I'm on Blue Sky at benwritesthings.bluesky.social. And people can follow me there and follow my work there.
Okay, Ben Miller, thank you very much. Thanks for coming.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Heist Podcast. We want to say thanks again to Ben Miller for his time today. And we want to remind you, you can check out his entire article, the feature on heistberlin.com. There you can sign up, you can become a donor, which we would greatly appreciate. But in the meantime, listen to the other couple episodes that we just dropped to launch the podcast properly. Otherwise, we'll be back in 2 weeks, and we'll see you then. Bye.